PaxWorld.com for tomorrow. This is an HPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Democrats in New Hampshire and nationally are once again trying to increase the minimum wage. Here in the Granite State, our minimum is tied to the federal level of $7.25 an hour. But this year, there are legislative efforts to raise it, first to $8.25 and then to $9 an hour. The bill comes as a dozen other states put higher minimums in place as of January 1st this year, including several in New England. But in New Hampshire, it'll be a tough sell. This is a big state for small business, and groups representing them have said they're worried a mandated increase would mean higher labor costs and ultimately fewer jobs. Still, as the legislative debate approaches, the other side's been making its case as well, including the rising tide lifts all boats theme that a little more money in the pockets of low-wage workers would create an overall economic boost. Today in The Exchange, what should the max be for the minimum wage? Let's hear from you. Should state lawmakers raise this base level of pay or not? And what do you make of the arguments surrounding this topic? Which ones make sense to you? Which don't? Give us a call. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. We have two guests for the hour. Bruce Berkey is here, New Hampshire State Director for the National Federation of Independent Businesses, a small business advocacy association with 1,500-plus members in the Granite State. Bruce Berkey, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Laura. Glad to be on the show.
Also with us, Jeff McLynch, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, an organization dedicated to promoting public policies that foster economic opportunity for New Hampshire residents. And Jeff McLynch, a welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and Jeff, I'm going to turn to you first, since you're the one advocating for change here. Make the case, Jeff, for increasing the minimum wage.
Sure. Well, I think when you stop and think about it, New Hampshire's minimum wage at present comes up short in a number of ways. First and foremost, someone working at the minimum wage just simply cannot make ends meet. I think we all agree that one of the principal values we as Granite Staters hold and we as Americans hold is in the value of work. And what flows out of that is the expectation is that if you work for a living, if you play fair by the rules and you work hard, you should be able to make ends meet. But that's simply not the case with the minimum wage in New Hampshire any longer.
So if you're working full-time on the minimum wage, just say, what is that in terms of an annual
salary?
You
make about $15,000 a year. And while that is above technically the federal poverty threshold, most analysts and most people who have to live at that level agree that that's woefully inadequate, that you can't buy basic necessities. Most of the research that looks at what you really need to get by for a single person living here in Concord, it's close to $20,000 a year. So by increasing the minimum wage, you take a big step forward to being able to make that threshold. I think another thing to consider is that we've seen part of the reason why it's so hard to get by is that we've seen a real erosion in the purchasing power of the minimum wage over the last 35 years. If you go back to the late 70s, the real value of the minimum wage was about $9.30 an hour. Today, it's just 7.25. So over three decades, we've lost $2 an hour in purchasing power. That's fewer groceries on the table, less gas in the car, fewer clothes on your kid's back, less heat in the apartment. So what does it say about us as a state if we've allowed that to occur? I think one other thing to consider is that we are already behind our other neighbors here in New England, and we're only going to fall further behind in the absence of action. You mentioned at the outset that a baker's dozens of states increased their minimum wages as of January 1. That includes Vermont, where the minimum is now $8.73, and where it will continue to rise because it's indexed to inflation. Connecticut this past year adopted legislation that took its minimum to $8.70 as of January 1st, but they're going to go to $9 next year. In Massachusetts, they're considering legislation that could take it as high as $11 an hour. So if we don't act, we're only going to fall further behind our region.
Well, Bruce Berkey, why not increase the minimum wage? $15,000 a year doesn't sound like a lot of money to live on.
That's true. However, there are very few, if any, full-time adults in the state of New Hampshire who are making minimum wage. You have a market at work here in New Hampshire that is creating wage base that is higher than the minimum wage. And if you increase the minimum wage, you're just going to increase those pressures upward on the entire wage structure. And so the National Federation of Independent Business believes that we should let the market work. Business already has dozens of regulations that they must adhere to, you know, whether it's the new Affordable Care Act, environmental regulations, OSHA, Health and Human Services, it just goes on and on. And so let's let the market work on the wage base here in New Hampshire.
Who are we talking about, Bruce? You said there are very few people actually, you know, making a living on this. Is this basically a teenage wage? Is that what we're talking about?
I think so, Laura, because you have over 50%, you have about 13,000 people in the state of New Hampshire who are in the minimum wage range of compensation. Over half of that, probably around 8,000 plus, are tipped employees. And for your listeners, tipped employees are people who are your waiters and waitresses and other types of activities, employment that have tips as part of their compensation. Right now, the minimum wage for that individual is 45%. By statute, of the minimum wage. So it's $3.26 today. Minimum wage employees, or tipped employees rather, are making much more than minimum wage. You know, you go into a restaurant and, you know, you pay $50 on a dinner bill, and at 15%, generally 20% some people pay. You're paying $7.50 to $10 in tip to that individual, and that person probably has three or four tables going during that hour that you're having dinner. And so they're easily making much more than the minimum wage.
I got another question for you, and then I want to get you back into this, Jeff. And also on the subject of tipped employees, in a few minutes we're going to be talking with someone from the Lodging and Restaurant Association a little bit more about that. But in terms of this broader issue, you mentioned something, Bruce, that raising the minimum wage would make upward pressure on other wage levels. Is that mandated that if the minimum goes up, all these other levels have to go up? Or is it more just a labor market pressure that the expectation will be that it goes up?
The expectation. And the pressures, you know, if I'm making $10 an hour today and the minimum wage is at $7.25 and it goes up to $9, then the person who's at $7.50 is now making $9. And I'm saying to my boss, well, you know, shouldn't I be making $11.50 now? Oh, he just went up $1.50. I should go up $1.50.
But the boss doesn't have to do that.
The boss doesn't have to do that, but it creates pressures on the relationship between the boss, the employee, and whereas if there's a free market that's taking place, you know, out there in the employment world, then you're going to have a much more robust employment market for people seeking work.
I want to ask you about that too, Jeff McLynch. But let me also invite our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're revisiting the minimum wage debate here in New Hampshire as about a dozen states increased their minimum wages this year. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. I want to ask you about this wage pressure issue, Jeff McLynch. You know, businesses say, look, if I have to raise wages by 10% or 20%, my profits aren't going up by 10% or 20%, so something's got to give.
Sure. Well, I think if I could first return to a point that Bruce alluded to, because I think it's a critical one in this debate, we need to be clear. The principal beneficiaries of a minimum wage increase in New Hampshire would be adults.
Not teenagers.
That's correct. If you were to take the minimum wage to $9 per hour, as has been proposed in legislation that Representative Kelly has filed, data from the U.S. Census Bureau indicate that 72% of the people who would benefit, whether directly or indirectly, are over the age of 20. Over a third are over the age of 30. It is not simply teenagers working part-time who would benefit. It is people who have to put food on the table, for themselves or their children, who are working to pay the rent, who are just trying to get ahead. It is not simply teenagers. It is principally adults who would benefit from that.
What about this idea that, again, if I have to raise wages by 10 or 20%, my profits aren't going up by 10 or 20%, so how do I cover that?
Sure. This is a question that's been very thoroughly examined in the research literature, and the most up-to-date research on this subject suggests that employers have a variety of ways of responding to these kind of pressures. One of the sort of positive things to take into account is that by putting more money in people's pockets, that's more money in local cash registers. People who earn the minimum wage by necessity spend every dollar that they earn, so that if they are earning more, they are spending more. And that means more purchases at local stores, whether it's convenience stores or clothes stores or grocery stores. The Chicago Fed looked at this question in, I think, 2001. They looked at about 20-plus years' worth of data. And what they found is that for every dollar increase in the minimum wage, spending in low-wage households rose by $700 per quarter in the quarters immediately following that increase. So that's a very beneficial impact. I would say also that businesses may get more out of their employees. They may become more productive in the wake of a minimum wage increase. Prices may rise in response. But again, that is, even if prices were to rise, it's still a large net benefit to low-wage people. What the research has settled upon, or at least the most recent research, is that there's no evidence of discernible job losses in response to minimum wage increases.
What do you think about this, Bruce? Jeff is, laying out this short-term, long-term thing. Short-term, you've said employers would have to lay people off. Long-term, he's saying, could be an economic boost as people have more cash in their pockets. What do you think?
I would almost reverse what Jeff is saying or what we're alluding to here, because I think that, short-term, there would be a little bit of an impact in terms of spending, local spending. But I think long-term, it's going to have an impact on reducing employment and economic output, and also on the long term category, the inflationary effect, because when you increase wages, you're going to have to increase prices to be able to pay for that, and so you're going to have a long-term negative impact on the local economy.
Lots more to talk about after a short break. You can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We'll be back in just a minute.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. It's 919. I'm David Darman. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting the final week of Africa Interweave, an opening Saturday, exploring the Currier Inside Out, Andrew Witkin, among others. Details at currier.org. And Mascoma Savings Bank, serving the people and needs of the Upper Connecticut River Valley since 1899. Online at mascomabank.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the minimum wage debate in the Granite State, with some states raising their minimums this year, others considering it. We're taking a look at the conversation here in New Hampshire, looking at the arguments, and we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. All one word. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Bruce Berkey. He's New Hampshire State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, along with Jeff McLynch, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Gentlemen, let's go to our callers. And Joan's waiting in Manchester. Hi, Joan. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. My basic comment is that if the minimum wage goes up, then people who are on general assistance, people who are on Medicaid, people who are on getting food stamps, housing assistance, all of that stuff, the benefits go down when the income goes up. And that has long-term effects and greater impact across the nation if legislators look at this and realize that they don't need to spend that money, you know, because there's extra money in the coffers because you don't have to pay for those things, you know. So the monetary market paradigm is inherently unequal. The inequality is there. So if you raise the minimum wage and people complain about it, then that's just the way it's going to be.
So, Joan, I'm not clear whether you think this is a good idea or not.
I think it's a good idea. I do, because not only do people have more money to spend now, you know, but they're going to have less in assistance. Yes, this is true. But right now, if you go to, say, a municipality like Franklin for assistance from welfare, if you happen to own a home and you're 79 years old, they're going to attach a lien on your home because you can't work and make enough money to pay that oil, and it's going to be 6% interest across the board, accruing every year.
I see what you're saying. So she seems to be saying, Jeff McLynch, that it's good for the individual, but also good for the taxpayers because then they don't need quite as much public assistance.
That's right. I think one of the goals that, if you look back 20 years with welfare reform, was the notion of making work pay. Obviously, if we increase the minimum wage, that creates a greater incentive, more attachment to the labor force, and can have potential benefits to the state in the form of reduced expenditures, cost savings for public benefit programs.
What do you think about that, Bruce Berkey?
Well, the concern that National Federation of Independent Business has is that you're still going to have a loss of jobs. And with the loss of jobs, we'll put more people on federal assistance or local assistance. And the academic research across the country supports the fact that there will be fewer jobs with the higher minimum wage.
What's happened in those states that have raised their minimums? Have they seen that?
I believe they have. Studies from the University of California, University of Georgia, San Diego, University of Miami. They have found that unemployment has increased when the minimum wage was raised, and this is hurting the people at the lower end of the wage scale.
Jeff, do you want to jump back in real quick, and then we got lots of callers.
Yeah, again, the most recent authoritative study on this, I think, dates to 2010, and it was conducted by researchers from North Carolina, Cal, and UMass. And they looked at the period from 1990 to 2006. They looked at 300 counties across the country, so a wide variety of states, counties where on one side of the border you had a higher state minimum, on the other side you had sort of the federal minimum. So it's a real natural experiment. You could try to discern what the impact of that minimum wage would be on employment. And when they controlled for all of that, they found no evidence of job losses. Now, obviously, an individual employer may respond differently, but overall, there is no evidence of job loss.
Well, thanks for that call, Joan. And let's take another one, gentlemen. This is Michael in Plymouth. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. Let's see. Unintended consequences, I think, is my thought. People forget that when you have fixed income, when you raise the base economy by raising a minimum wage, everything rises. That is empirical evidence that's not, controlled and all that the last gentleman just spoke about. Prices rise. People on fixed income suffer more. They scream more for more money, and so we spend more money trying to give them a basic living.
So the inflationary argument is what you're hearing, Michael.
And from the practical sense, I happen to know personally at least 17 businessmen here in this area who are already looking at how they're going to have to reduce their staff or staff hours or otherwise increase productivity because their overhead is going up because of things like Obamacare and, you know, this threat of increasing the minimum wage, because there is a pressure for everybody else's price to go up.
Michael, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call. And Bruce Berkey, this is something you raised early, the inflationary aspect. And to businesses, he says it feels like just another piling on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what I spoke about earlier in terms of the Affordable Care Act, environmental regulations, health regulations, OSHA. It's the dampening of the market by putting another control on it is just not a positive for New Hampshire's small business community.
Well, then, Jeff, we learn in Econ 101 that when wages go up, the price of everything else goes up. How concerned are you about this inflationary effect that our caller mentions and that Bruce mentions?
I think it's worth taking a step back here and thinking about what type of businesses employ low-wage workers. And at least at the national level, the data suggests that two-thirds of minimum wage employees are employed by very large businesses, corporations with more than 100 employees.
McDonald's, Burger King.
Right. So we're talking about nationwide organizations. And when you stop to think about it, those large corporations have seen a really sustained period of high profitability in recent years. And so they may be able to withstand paying higher wages as a result. As I alluded to earlier, employers can respond in a whole variety of ways to higher wages. They may see greater demand. They may see some reduced profitability. One other thing that I hadn't touched on is you're likely to see reduced turnover among minimum wage employees because now they're making a higher wage. That is a real benefit to employers because, as everyone knows, there are costs to hiring people. There's time costs for interviews.
Training, so
forth. Exactly.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in super quick, Bruce, and then back to our callers?
Just real quick. When you have the wage go up and the more mature applicant perhaps filling that wage, you know, our kids are losing opportunities to break into the workforce, gain some experience, and have that, you know, job at the bottom like we all did when we were 16, 17, 18 years old.
Let's take another call now. And joining us by phone is Mike Summers. He's president and chief executive officer of the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association. Mike Summers, thank you for taking some time out for us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
Well, what are the particular concerns of businesses in that restaurant and lodging industry about a possible increase in the minimum wage, Mike?
So a variety of concerns, and I'm afraid I'm going to end up echoing a lot of what Bruce just said. But, you know, a couple of just generic statistics to share with you. You know, in the United States, I think one in four working adults got their start in the restaurant industry. We all worked, waiting tables, bartending, busboy, whatever. And our industry has historically been an entry point into the workforce, to echo what Bruce said. And what we see when we see increases in the minimum wage is that there are fewer and fewer of those entry-level jobs available to the high school kid or the, you know, just starting into college students. And so it's really put kind of a deleterious effect. And we're actually starting to experience this kind of on a, you know, a long-term trend here that, you know, as we try to hire younger folks, you know, in their early 20s, they really don't have any work experience when they come through our doors. And so this ability to kind of train folks up over time, we're really starting to lose that, and we're just starting to lose that now, and this is going to continue to progress. And then to go back to a point that Bruce made earlier, our biggest concern here in New Hampshire is our tip minimum wage is tied to the minimum wage at 45%, so $3.27 an hour. And if you talk to any server in any restaurant in the state of New Hampshire, I would guarantee that none of them are making less than $10 an hour, and I would suspect most of them are making over $15 an hour if they actually averaged out tips hourly, et cetera. So really what we'll end up doing by forcing this minimum wage onto restaurants, and Bruce made this point earlier as well, you know, more than half of the folks making minimum wage in New Hampshire are tipped employees. So what will end up happening within a restaurant is you will force business owners to give a raise to the individuals that really don't need it in the operation, which will then take some of those salary resources within the business and take it away from raises that they could be giving to the folks in the back of the house, in the kitchen, et cetera, who might be making $10 an hour. Instead of giving them a 50-cent raise this year, they were going to be passing it out to all the servers in the front of the house. So it ends up, and again, it goes back to one of those unintended consequences.
Could you somehow fashion a minimum wage, Mike, that, okay, maybe we don't include tipped workers in this since they do make money off of tips. Maybe we don't include teenagers since, you know, there is that whole training aspect that you and Bruce have talked about. But is there a way to fashion a minimum wage increase that would help those working adults who, Jeff McLynch has said, are just trying to put food on the table and really struggling to do so?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is, let me make two comments. First and foremost, I think if you look at the trends over time over the last 20 years, and Jeff may be able to speak to this better than I can, we are seeing less and less people actually making minimum wage today than we did 20 years ago. And a big part of that goes back to Bruce's point earlier, where the market is working. And if we let the market work, what you will find is less and less adults will actually be making minimum wage. What I would also say is, of the adults over the age of, say, 24 or 25 who are making minimum wage, if you dig deeper into the numbers, what you find is that most of them, it's a part-time second job to make a little extra money for Christmas or whatever it might be. Very few folks are making minimum wage, working 40 hours a week, and just trying to provide for families. There are so few of those folks in the system.
You know, some argue that raising the minimum wage will put more money in the pockets of low-wage workers, be it part-time or more, and that the overall economy would benefit, maybe even some of your members, Mike. You know, some of the restaurants, for example, if lower-income people had more money, maybe they'd go out to eat more. I wonder what you think about that side of the argument, Mike, that economic boost side of the argument.
Again, I kind of echo what Bruce said earlier. Would there be some short-term, just the money goes through the system a little quicker? Quite certainly. But I think the more important question is, at what cost? I think the concerning part for my members in our industry would be, you know, the loss of jobs, the pressures on businesses in general. And let's face it, in New Hampshire, we are so reliant on small businesses. You know, how many does this, between this and some changes to the cost structures within the businesses with the Affordable Care Act, and then you talk about what we've seen in our industry and the dramatic increase in the price of food and heating and cooking, et cetera, you know, at what point do we just start to force businesses out of the mix? And that really honestly is our fear.
Okay, Mike Summers, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Mike Summers, President and Chief Executive Officer of the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association. The number for you to join us on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in from David in Ware. He says, is there any precedent for raising the minimum wage selectively? For example, for all those under 18 with no dependents. Could this eliminate the possibility of reducing entry-level jobs for teens as the minimum wage increases? Jeff McLynch, I want to throw that to you first. I talked with Mike Summers also a little bit about that. Could you increase the minimum for those folks that you seem to think really need that increase? Those working adults trying to put food on the table.
Again, I think it's important to return to the question of who would benefit if the minimum wage were to rise here in New Hampshire. As Mike pointed out, what you've seen in recent decades is a change in the composition of the low-wage workforce. That workforce is becoming older and older over time, which means that there are more and more adults who are working at low wages. Therefore, if you were to increase the minimum wage, they're the people who would benefit the most. It may be that other states have considered training wages or may have them in place, but for the purposes of this discussion, I think because the minimum wage would benefit adults the most, it's important to stay focused on those people.
Yeah, well, so you're not excited about the idea of a so-called training wage, for example, for younger workers, or exempting those tipped workers who most people seem to feel are already making well above the minimum.
Well, again, the legislation that's on the table keeps in place that sort of sub-minimum wage for tipped employees
for tipped workers.
At 45%, while they would benefit because the base is rising, that percentage doesn't change. Yet there are a number of states who have moved towards eliminating that sub-minimum altogether and paying a full minimum wage to tipped employees. One of the points that Mike made is that we should allow the market to work. The market isn't working for low-wage workers in New Hampshire. If you look back over the past several decades, productivity in New Hampshire has risen substantially by well over 100%, 114% in three decades. That means that compensation should rise too, and compensation for everybody should rise. But wages for low-wage workers in New Hampshire have just risen by 10%. The market isn't working for those people, and that's why we need a minimum wage increase.
I want to bring another voice into our conversation, gentlemen. This is Judy Statman. She's campaign coordinator for the New Hampshire AFL-CIO, which, as I understand, Judy, is holding a news conference on this very subject today. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, we will be having a press conference this afternoon with our AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler, who will be talking about the need to raise the minimum wage in New Hampshire and some other policies to support working families here.
When I think about union workers, Judy, I don't think of them as making the minimum wage. I think of them as having good negotiated contracts and solid wages and solid benefits. So why is this important to your members?
Well, New Hampshire AFL-CIO SEIO is committed to improving conditions for working people in the state, period. One of the ways we do that is to support collective bargaining, but we also support public policies and business practices that increase work opportunities and good jobs. And by our net definition, good jobs are jobs that pay families sustaining wages and provide core benefits like health care, like paid vacation and sick days, and retirement benefits. So one of the opportunities we look for in the labor movement is how to turn bad jobs, like low-wage, no-benefit jobs in the fast food and retail sector, into jobs that are better for working families and more sustainable for our economy. Raising the minimum wage is a good place to start, and it's going to have immediate benefits for thousands of New Hampshire working families. So,
even if it doesn't directly involve union people?
Oh, well, you know, the labor movement is about workers. It's not just about union workers. And you know, our commitment is making sure that there are good work opportunities for all workers in New Hampshire.
One of the concerns that we've heard repeated this morning, Judy, and I want to know what you think, is businesses, especially small businesses that Bruce Berkey is representing, who say, look, this is going to increase my costs by whatever percent, let's just say 10% or 15%, and my revenue isn't going up by 10 or 15%. So there's going to be a hit to those businesses and ultimately perhaps the workers that you guys are trying to help out.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to really think about the scale here, because the fact of the matter is that probably around 95% of the New Hampshire workforce is making above $9 an hour at this point. So we're really talking about a pretty small sector of workers that would be hit. And I think, as Jeff McLynch noted, you know, these are mostly people who are working for, you know, large corporations in some way, fast food workers, people in the retail sector who are working for chain stores. It's not most New Hampshire businesses are you know, paying above the minimum wage now, and they're paying above that $9 mark as well. But we do see people concentrated in, you know, the retail sector and in the food service sector who are really making extremely low wages. And it's just, I mean, those are poverty wages for families. It's not a wage that can sustain even an individual with no dependents. So my son worked for a fast food restaurant when he was in going to community college, and he was working full-time, and he barely was making enough money to put gas in the tank of his car every week. So, you know, I think we really need to put some perspective here on that, you know, having just low-wage jobs in our economy.
Okay, and Judy, I got to wrap you up there, but I do appreciate your time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
And we'll be back after a short break.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, nearly 4 years after the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling, the state of campaign finance reform, then an environmental outlook on the passenger pigeons' flight to extinction and what it teaches us about conservation, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show, beginning this morning at 10 o'clock on NHPR. And support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, creating eco-friendly and healthy sleep environments. Also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. And New Hampshire Magazine, featuring an article on the Northern Pass Project plus photography on the edge with Jay Philbrick. New Hampshire Magazine, where New Hampshire comes to you. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the minimum wage debate in the Granite State. We're looking at how this conversation has evolved nationally and what's happening in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, go to our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, to check out an infographic looking at the New Hampshire minimum wage in comparison to other states. Pretty interesting. Check it out again on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Our guests for the hour, Bruce Berkey, New Hampshire State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, and Jeff McLynch, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Gentlemen, lots of calls, lots of emails. I'd love to share some of them with you right now. Here's one from David, who is listening from London, England, where they have, David says, a tiered minimum wage with four categories: apprentice, under 18s, 18 to 20, and 21 plus, David says this approach would seem to secure entry-level possibilities for teens. This is something we talked about a couple minutes ago, but I'd love your thoughts, both of you, Bruce, you first, on how they do it across the pond in England.
Well, here on this side of the pond, Laura, I did have I reached out to some of my clients over the last couple of days regarding this issue note in anticipation of this morning's show. And I had one seasonal employer get back to me, and he said, the only people we really pay minimum wage to are under the age of 18, and we would prefer if they called it a training wage, which would be more appropriate. They really don't have marketable skills in the grand scheme of things. And so that is something that isn't being done on a probably broad basis.
Or as formally as they do in England. But it's happening already, you're saying.
I think it's happening. You know, that $7.25, you know, cent wage, minimum wage, allows that 16-year-old to enter the workforce, to gain some experience, and to be able to increase their marketable skills.
What do you think about that, Jeff, real quick?
I do think we want to try to create job opportunities for everybody in New Hampshire, whether they're 16 or 26 or 36. But I think it's just as important to look at the reality of someone who's not 16 and who is trying to put food on the table for himself or herself or her children and ensure that the wage that they receive from their employer is sufficient to that task. And that's why we need a higher minimum wage.
Here's another email from another David, this one closer to home in Somersworth, who says, if full-time workers are qualifying for assistance, then we are subsidizing those companies. This gets to our other caller's earlier point about people being on public assistance. And she said if the wage went up, maybe they wouldn't need so much public assistance. So David says, wages have not increased for average workers in accordance with corporate profits, and especially executive pay. So he seems to be making the case there, Bruce Berkey, that, you know, by keeping wages low for some workers, we're subsidizing companies through our taxes, through public assistance. Maybe if we paid folks more, they wouldn't need that public assistance. This is a point that came up earlier. I wonder what you think.
It is a point that's calculable, but I think that, you know, if it does occur, those jobs that are out there are potentially going to disappear. And so that's going to create even more public assistance to be necessary.
Gets to that point that you made earlier.
Right.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in quick on that, Jeff, and then back to our callers?
I do think it is troubling the extent to which some employers may be subsidized by state or federal government. We want to make sure that the wage that people earn is sufficient for them to maintain a basic standard of living. And if that has to be supplemented because employers have held down wages, that's of concern. If you look back in New Hampshire, the case has certainly been that wages for low-wage people have been stagnant for close to three decades and that they've actually declined over the course of the recession. So you need to make sure that both wages and public assistance programs are adequate.
Let's take another call if we could. And thanks for those emails to those two Davids. And this is Richard in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Here I am. Yes. I understand that there's an obscene difference between the income of the top wage earners and of the large group of low wage earners. So as a consequence, I believe it's no problem at all for the wealthy to share a little bit of the wealth with the rest of us. And I think Bertolt Brecht said it very well when he said, if you weren't so rich, I would not be so poor.
So this gap between the rich and poor, Richard, you're saying that alone is a reason to raise the minimum wage?
Absolutely.
We talked earlier, Richard, I'm just curious what you think about the inflationary pressures of raising the minimum wage, which would hit everybody on all income levels. I wonder what you think about that.
I don't necessarily think that's so, because I think that the wage earners that are going to benefit are people who are purchasing basic substances, not stuff which are luxuries, and I don't think that's going to raise significantly. And even if it does raise a little, it sure is a heck of a lot better to be able to pay a little bit more for the food and not pay for it at all.
Okay. Richard, thank you very much for the call. You know, this is a broader issue, Bruce Berkey, this gap between rich and poor that we see in this country. Some folks, including Democrats in Congress, see raising the minimum wage as a way to close that gap.
I think the market closes that gap. And I think it's very reflective of the experience we've had here in New Hampshire, because you have of the 13,000 who are making minimum wage in the state, as we mentioned, over half of those are the tipped employees who are, at the end of the day, are probably not making minimum wage. And then you also have less than 6% of those are single parents. Less than 5% are the sole earner of a married couple. And in all likelihood, those are second jobs. Or maybe they're additional sources to their retirement, Social Security. So it's not as stark, I don't think, as the numbers might suggest.
That's a point that Mike Summers made earlier. Jeff, real quick to you.
Yeah, if I could speak to that, I think Richard raises a really good point. There's some interesting research that looks back over the last several decades, and what it finds is that growth of income inequality that Richard touched upon is not only very real, but one of the principal factors that explains that growth in income inequality is the erosion of the real value of the minimum wage. We've allowed it to deteriorate, and as a result, that gap has grown. In New Hampshire, incomes for people at the very top of the income distribution, the top fifth, grew by well over 80% in the last few decades. For people at the bottom, they grew by only about a quarter. So there is a rising gap here in New Hampshire, and one of the ways that we can help to address it is by raising the minimum wage.
Thanks for that call, Richard. Let's go to Bill, also in Massachusetts, calling in from Lowell. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I just want to try and make a point. I'm in the military. I probably make about $50,000 a year, so I'm not a rich person whatsoever. But what I keep hearing here is we want to take from the rich people and give it to the poor. That's all I hear here is an employer's job is not a social program for the poor. I have a business. I've created that business. I've worked really hard. I can create some jobs. And I can help some people, but it's not my job to make sure that you can put a 60-inch TV in your house or drive a BMW. That's not why I'm here. So I'm just a regular guy defending kind of what I think is common sense. My son is 17. He washes dishes at a local hospital in the food service, so he wanted to make a little bit of extra money. He makes over the minimum wage. Why? Because the hospital decided on their own that that type of job deserved this much pay. They weren't told you have to do this. They did it all by themselves. So my point is, we regulate everything. Let's try and stay out of this. If I'm a business owner and you tell an owner, if you tell me that I have to raise my minimum wage, then I might have to let two guys go.
I have a quick question for you, Bill.
Everybody.
Yeah, and sure. Thank you very much for calling. I have a quick question for you then. And I'm going to ask Jeff McLynch what he thinks about your broader point that employers aren't social engineers, so to speak. Should there be any minimum, Bill?
There should be a minimum, yes. And it should... And obviously there was a minimum back in the, 1800s, it was maybe 10 cents an hour, whatever. Yes, it can go up, but so we're not all equal. A guy who pumps gas for a living should not be paid equally as a dentist. And I keep hearing this equality thing. Well, we're not all equal. A radio host makes X amount of dollars. Should he or she be making equally amount of pay as a person who mops floors? We're not all equally. It's just equal. It just doesn't match up.
Okay.
You know, if you go to work for a food service company, a Burger King, for example, you know what that pays. It does not pay $25 an hour. It's common sense. If you want more money, work harder, get educated, do what you need to do to make money. Don't ask for handouts. And this is what I see this is they're rich. Let's take from them because I'm poor.
Okay. And Bill, I'm going to let you go, but thank you very much for calling in. It's good to hear from you. Good to hear from a couple Massachusetts callers today. What do you think? He makes a couple points that I'd love to hear from you on, Jeff McLynch. You know, look, if you want more money, don't complain about the minimum wage. Get an education, work harder, get into a different field. It's not up to employers to better your lot in life.
Sure. I don't think that anybody who's working the minimum wage is sitting down at their kitchen table looking at glossy brochures for a BMW or an Audi or trying to figure out the latest in HD technology. What they're probably trying to do is figure out which bill to pay that month, whether it's the heat bill, the electricity bill, their phone bill. They are not only working, but they're probably trying to figure out, okay, is there another job that I can take to try to make ends meet? How do I better my lot in life? Can I go out and get an education? And people are trying to do that. I think we have to acknowledge the reality that for people who aren't able to get a higher education for any number of reasons, whether they're trying to raise children, they don't have the capital to invest at the time, we need to make sure that they maintain a basic standard of living. People are, by definition, someone who is earning the minimum wage is working for a living. They are earning that wage. And so it's not any kind of handout. It's a hand up.
What do you think about the question I asked him, Bruce Berkey? Should we even have a minimum? I mean, if it's really about market forces, should we even have a minimum?
That's a fair question, one that's worth debating. I will say that my client, the National Federation of Independent Business, has not taken a position on that. So I'm a little frightened to step out there.
All right. And what do you think about our caller's other point that, look, you know, not everybody's created equal, and this is about social engineering. And look, that's not the responsibility of businesses.
I thought Bill's points were excellent. The business community is out there. They do give great experiences for young people to be able to, you know, enter the workforce and throughout their business careers or their employment careers. They will have different opportunities based upon their performance.
Lots of emails have come in, and thanks to everybody who's emailed and called. I won't be able to get to all these emails, but here's a couple that I'd like to get to before we close out. This is from Robin. He says, the underlying disagreement about minimum wage is this. Should a worker be paid according to his or her consumption needs, or should the worker be paid according to the economic value of the labor? If the worker's labor is not worth enough to support his or her consumption needs, then we have a dilemma, Robin says. The worker cannot support him or herself on a standalone basis. Either we compel the employer to overpay and accept the economic consequences, for instance, less employment and or inflation, or we supplement the consumption needs with governmental side payments and accept the consequences of that, for instance, higher taxes to pay for SNAP, et cetera, SNAP being food stamps. Robin's getting at a couple points that we've talked about this hour, and I'd love to touch on his first one. To you, I think first, Bruce, should a worker be paid according to his or her consumption needs, or should they be paid according to the economic value of the labor? We keep hearing about it's not enough to, you know, make a living on. I wonder what you think about Robin's point.
Well, I think it's an excellent point in terms of the you know, adding to this debate. But I think that, you know, our system is built upon paying someone for the value they bring to the job that they perform. And that is what I think our economic structure will continue to be. If the person is not creating value for the employer and you know, the employer has to pay them more for the value they bring to the job or the table, I just don't think that that's going to work.
Go ahead, Jeff. I want your thoughts on this, too. You've talked a lot about, you know, minimum wage isn't enough to pay the heat, to pay the groceries, to pay for medications or whatever.
Sure. I think one good measure of economic value is sort of productivity of the workforce. And what we've seen in New Hampshire over the last several decades is a substantial growth in productivity in the neighborhood of about 115%. All told, which means that you would expect that wages would grow by that amount and that wages for everybody would grow substantially given that sort of increase in economic productivity. We haven't seen that here in New Hampshire, particularly at the low end of the wage scale. For workers in the bottom 20% of the wage distribution, they've seen their wages grow by only about 10% over the last 30 plus years or so. So they're not being paid in accordance with their contribution to the overall market economy. That's why you need interventions like the minimum wage.
When was the last time the minimum wage was increased?
In New Hampshire, it was last increased in 2008 to $7.25. Federal changes have caught up with that. I believe the federal minimum was taken to $7.25 in 2010.
Okay.
But to that point, we used to see much more regular increases in the minimum wage at the state and federal level so that the value of the wage was not eroded by inflation. But again, over the last 30-plus years, we've seen a pretty sharp drop-off in the purchasing power of the wage so that somebody today has to work an hour and 20 minutes, hour and 15 minutes to the hour that someone had to work 30 years ago just to get the same purchasing power.
Well, and inflation has been low over the past 5 years because of the recession. But Bruce Berkey, it hasn't been non-existent. Certainly cost me a lot more to fill up my car than it used to. So what about that? The fact that the minimum wage hasn't gone up since 2008, that's 5 years of no increase while prices have gone up.
No doubt about it. But I think that if you looked at wages, not the minimum wage, but if you looked at wages across the board in New Hampshire, you would see that they have gone up. The fact that it takes an hour and 15 or 20 minutes to make what a $7.25 made 5 years ago, well, that person who was making $7.25 5 years ago isn't making $7.25
You're saying
today.
They probably moved up
absolutely
since then.
Absolutely. And generally, people are getting increases in wages probably within 3 to 6 months, certainly no longer than a year.
Real quick last question for both of you. You first, Bruce, what do you think is going to happen in the legislature with this bill?
Great debate.
You don't want to make any predictions about how it's going to go.
It'll pass the House, and the question mark will be in the Senate.
Sure. You agree with that, Jeff?
My hope is the policymakers listen to their constituents, who by and large will likely support a minimum wage increase, and that will move forward to $9 an hour.
Okay. Jeff McLynch, good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Jeff McLynch, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Bruce Berkey, thank you also for your time. Good to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
Bruce Berkey, New Hampshire State Director for the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Again, if you go to our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, you can check out an infographic looking at the New Hampshire minimum wage in comparison to other states. There may be also some other information there for you, so check it out, NHPR Exchange, all one word. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer today is David Darman. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. A volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the state of homelessness in the Granite State. Even though the numbers show a small decline in the overall population of homeless people, a new report paints a more complex picture, including that the number of unsheltered homeless has jumped by 20% over the past year. We'll look once again at this stubborn problem and ongoing efforts to address it. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
NHPR, it's 9:59. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show is coming up next. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Monadnock Chorus, presenting a Lithuanian Christmas with ethnic dancers and traditional music on January 11th at 4 p.m. at the Peterborough Townhouse. Tickets at monadnock-chorus.org. And Sunapee Cove Assisted Living on Lake Sunapee in Georges Mills. Chef-prepared meals and engaging activities in a lakeside atmosphere that celebrates life. Models open daily, sunapeecove.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
The Supreme Court handed down their landmark Citizens United ruling, dramatically altering campaign finance in America. The decision allowed corporations and labor unions to spend unlimited money directly on politics.